Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to New Books in European Studies. I'm Liz Spragans, a host of the channel and assistant professor of Spanish at College of the Holy Cross. Today, we'll be talking to Emily Colbert-Cairns about her new book, Esther in Early Modern Iberia and the Sephardic Diaspora, Queen of the Conversas, published with Palgrave Macmillan in 2017. Emily is assistant professor of Spanish at the Department of Modern and Classical Languages at Salve Regina University in Newport, Rhode Island, and her research focuses on marginalized groups in the early modern Atlantic world, approximately 1500 to 1700, with a focus on literature, historical records, and the visual arts. She has published on Converso and Crypto-Jewish Identity in the Early Modern Period in I Humanista, Chasqui, Cervantes Journal, and Hispanófila. Emily Colbert-Cairns, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much. Thanks for having me.
It's a pleasure to have you. Emily, I wonder if you could begin the interview by telling us a bit about yourself.
Sure. I graduated with a double major in Spanish and math from Hamilton College, and then I did my PhD and master's at the University of California, Irvine. And it was there that I knew I was interested in Jewish populations and women, but my interest in the medieval and early modern came about with my advisor, Michelle Hamilton. Was at the University of Minnesota now, and she really introduced me to texts about thriving populations in Al-Andalus and ideas of tolerance and convivencia. And my interest from undergrad in Jewish populations in Latin America kind of morphed to a transatlantic interest and moved earlier when I saw all the literature that was out there and the difference in populations at that time.
Great. That's such an interesting journey. I feel like so many American scholars, particularly that work in this area, have followed a similar path of getting kind of sucked down the rabbit hole of multicultural Iberia. Could you tell us a little bit about how you came to write Esther in Early Modern Iberia and the Sephardic Diaspora?
Yeah, sure. So my dissertation was on Jews in the early modern world, and I worked on a bunch of different texts, things like Celestina, which is a classic in medieval literature, and other things. And I was really looking to make that my big project, but it really didn't lend itself. My dissertation was kind of disparate. And then the more I worked on my topic, the more Esther kind of came out as this connecting tissue between different texts. And the title of my book, Queen of the Conversas, Esther, for those who aren't as familiar, she's the queen of the story of Purim from the Bible, and it's kind of a lesser story, but for Jews it's really important. She's the only one who has her own book, and she's the story of this underdog, this woman who kind of wins a beauty contest, goes in front of the the Persian royalty and becomes queen when the king kicks out his first wife for disobedience. And she doesn't reveal her Jewish identity. She's kind of taught not to, and does in a crucial moment when the king, under his advisor's advice, is about to kill the whole Jewish population. So she's really this crucial heroine for Jewish people, for Jewish women, and she really resonates with the converso populations. So I was at this time, one of the big parts of my dissertation that I really was interested in were the trials of the Carvajal sisters, Isabel and Leonor. And their brother, Luis de Carvajal, is a really important figure who's written his own autobiography, and people talk about him a lot. And I was interested in these two women, and I got to work with their manuscripts. They're in the UC Berkeley Special Collections, in the Bancroft Library. And so I got to work with those, and that was something that just kept sticking out to me. And they talked about Esther in their documents. And I said, what else is out there? And there's a bunch of different things that I found. So the book kind of came from that place, and then I explored all the different Esther retellings from that same period, so 16th and 17th centuries.
That's really fascinating. Could you give us a sense of who are all of these different Esthers that you're describing in this project?
Yeah, so my project looks at both a Christian perspective and a Jewish perspective, because what I found was there were retellings both written by really prominent Christian figures and within really Christian forms, like the Auto Sacramental, which is a one-act play about religious topics, only found in Spain. And then I also found text written by Jews, converso Jews, who had returned to Judaism, to openly practicing Judaism in the diaspora, like in Amsterdam, which is the case of Juan Pinto Delgado in a later chapter. And so I was looking at these things and saying, how is it that this is a text that resonates with both sides? And conversos kind of straddled that boundary because they were living publicly as Christians and privately as Jews. Not all, but crypto-Jews, so the distinction is crypto-Jews were living publicly as one thing, privately as something else. And so, I that to me is like, okay, this is a figure that resonates with both sides of this identity and then with different populations. So how does that manifest? And what are the differences in these texts? And so the book looks at, through a gendered perspective, these nine different retellings from both sides.
Maybe you could give us a bit of background history on, what you explained a little bit what a converso is and what a crypto Jew is, but what's the history on the Iberian Peninsula of that? This seems like it's a really fundamental part of your project that at least leads into the 16th century, even if the history starts back in the 14th century.
Sure, definitely. So 1391 is this watershed moment, the first mass conversions and attacks on the Jewish population. And there's, for the first time living in Iberia, we have within the same families, we'll have converted Jews or conversos, we'll have within those crypto Jews, the ones who continue practicing Judaism, we'll have kind of conversos who are very faithful to their new religion, and these are divided on family lines, and they separated families, and we'll still have Jews and Christians, and they were all living together. 1492 is the moment when Judaism is officially kicked out from the peninsula. Jews are in exile. Anyone who's remained has to convert, and we lose those normative Jews on the peninsula. What then happens is we get the creation of new and old Christians, as that's an emerging, the conversos being new Christians, and old Christians can trace their families back on all sides to Christian grandparents. So the history there is quite important. And we're looking by the 17th century, there are still conversos on the peninsula, but the practices that they have over the centuries have that connect them to their original Jewish identity I don't want to say less, have lessened, but they've been mixed a lot. And so when we have a case like Juan Pinto Delgado, Juan Pinto Delgado, who returns to normative practicing Judaism in Amsterdam, his version of what Judaism is very different. When I talk about the Carvajal sisters, they are conversas who are crypto Jews in 1595 in the Americas, actually, in New Spain, which is today Mexico.
Fascinating. So what was it, just to start at that kind of prehistory, what was it that happened in 1391 that led to this watershed moment? So what was going on the Iberian Peninsula that led to this creation of all of these new categories of converso, new Christian, old Christian?
Sure, there was attacks on the Jewish populations and the first mass pogroms they started in southern Spain, and they, you know, would invoke kind of mass conversions upon those practicing Jews, and that's what started. I don't know if I should say the beginning of the end, but it's the beginning of where we see these mixed identities living along the Iberian Peninsula together.
Great. So could you maybe talk a little bit about, so you're using these nine texts as your archive that you're departing from. Could you tell us a little bit about how you arrived at these nine texts? So you've said that you initially noticed Esther as being this important figure in the Carvajal documents in the Bancroft at Berkeley. How did you come across the next eight?
Sure. I wanted to add something to the last question, if I can go out of order a little bit.
Yeah,
there was an important priest, Vicente Ferrer, that kind of waged this campaign against the Jewish population and wrote treatises against them, and that's what sparked those events that we were just talking about with the first mass conversions. Going forward to your question, I was interested in what was going around these Carvajal women in the Inquisition, what was happening around that they were experiencing. And so I looked to see, I just did a wide search to see what are other texts written about Esther. I assume there were more. There was contemporary Bibles that were circulated by the conversa population, and the Carvajals most likely had access to them, the Ferrara Sedur, the Biblia Latinada, and these were contemporary texts they had access, well, the Carvajal women had access to, particularly because their families were deeply involved in a transatlantic trade within Africa and Northern Europe and the New World. And so I just said, okay, to myself, there has to be others. And there were within the Sephardic population. There was Juan Pinto Delgado's in Amsterdam, his Poema de la Reina Esther. Within Spain, there was Autos Sacramentales, and I got to take a great trip to the Biblioteca Nacional to look at those, the Autos Sacramentales. Really exciting to me were these tapestries that are in Zaragoza, and these are visual celebrations of the story of Queen Esther. It's a whole three series tapestry, huge, beautifully adorned in detail. And these are a little bit later than the Carvajal women, but this is also celebrating this story. And so, and I recommend anyone going to visit them. They're at the Museo del Aseo in Zaragoza, and it's amazing to see them in person because they're huge. And these were tapestries that were taken out and every year during the Holy Week and put on the walls, the exterior walls of the church within the central plaza. And if anyone's been to Zaragoza, it's a big plaza. And so these were kind of living documents that up until a couple hundred years ago, they were taken out every year. And so they're still telling the story and celebrating this history. And I said, well, you know, how does that come to be? And then there was also Felipe Godinez's texts, his plays, theatrical representations about the story of Queen Esther that he wrote on either side of his Inquisition trial, which I found really interesting. How does this change? What are the differences? And he wrote he's somewhat well known, but not very well known. But he wrote in the same style as Lope de Vega, who's a really important Spanish playwright. And so these kind of connections emerged. And I said, there's a conversation happening here. They were contemporaries. It stands to reason that Godinez would have read Lopez's version. And so it was pretty, it emerged pretty quickly once I, you know, took hold of this figure.
So it sounds like you've got this really, really diverse collection of texts that you're working with. You've got poetry, you've got visual texts, you've got drama. How are you theorizing the connections among these? You know, clearly there's this sort of uniting figure of Esther, but what are some of the ideas that you feel like these wide variety of texts are all speaking with?
Yeah, that's definitely. So I look at them all through a gendered perspective and what is the female body telling us about this period that other figures are not able to communicate. And so within the crypto-Jewish population, I argue that crypto-Judaism is a matriarchal religion because the patriarchy was absent, usually due to business and travel and transatlantic trade. But the women within both the Iberian Peninsula and the New World emerged as the stable matriarchy. And so they upheld, and so the fact that Esther became their heroine and their queen, and they had other models, contemporary models within the Christian society, Isabel la Católica, the Virgin Mary, and she became heightened for them because of that. And so this gendered perspective and the idea of difference and otherness, is the kind of the connecting tissue between all of these texts.
And then I guess one final question before we move on to some of the content of the book. How do you feel like your project is in conversation with some of the broader trends of scholarship on the medieval and early modern Sephardic studies within our field?
Yeah, so one of the main aspects that emerged for me was the idea, and this is one of my conclusions, was that the Sephardic identity exists beyond geographical boundaries, and the Sephardic identity of this period contests the idea of national borders and the idea that they have double and multiple loyalty, these figures. And there's been a lot of really interesting texts, scholarship recently about I'm thinking of David Wax and Jonathan Israel and their kind of double identity. I think David Wax calls it a double identity. And I thought about that a lot in my work because these Converso Jews have a double loyalty both to Spain and to Israel. And so there's this kind of dual notion of homeland that's really prevalent. So on that front, and then just thinking about these transatlantic, we talk a lot in terms of transatlantic identities today in our field, which I find really interesting. And so these are figures that are inherently transatlantic and global. And I think we're trying to kind of undo some of the older boundaries of we're talking about Spanish works within the Iberian Peninsula, and we're looking at trends that go beyond national boundaries. And these are figures that are also inherently border transgressors. And they have connections to medieval French literature and to, you know, we're kind of removing around the globe in a period where I think it was really prevalent, but we don't necessarily think of it today in those terms.
Yeah. I mean, it seems like such a rich way of exploring how Spanish identity was emerging in this period, because precisely the moment that that crypto-Judaism and conversos become sort of a problem for the Spanish crown is when they're trying to consolidate this idea of a Spanish nation, you know, with the publication of Nebrija's grammar in 1492 as well. And yeah, I mean, it seems like such a rich area to explore that goes beyond what some of the other most recent scholarship has been working on, but is really mobilizing some of these ideas about you know, what is nation, what is identity, what are some of these characteristics that people are really grappling with. So as we move on to the content of the book, I thought that maybe one piece of necessary knowledge for the non-Hispanists and non-Iberianists might be a bit of background on what is the Spanish Inquisition beyond sort of what's available to modern audiences right. In Monty Python.
Yeah. So the Inquisition had the central, the Supremo, the central organizing body was in Spain, but they had other centers in the New World. So Mexico, which was called New Spain, Peru, also in Brazil, so and Cartagena de India. So there's these different centers in Colombia. There's different centers of the Inquisition. And the Inquisition, we think about it a lot in terms of trying to root out Jews and Muslims and persecute them. And there was a definite component of that. But the Inquisition was also there to – this was in the terms of what the inquisitors in the Catholic Church was trying to do to kind of correct the wrongs of the Spanish populace, of the Catholic believers. And so there also were trials for people who behaved in ways that didn't conform to the Catholic social order. And when I think about it in my work, a lot of it is how did – the Inquisition, in many ways, they ended up kind of teaching sometimes crypto-Jews about how to be Jewish because they had a list of different behaviors, eating different foods, observing the Sabbath, fasting on certain days, keeping kosher or laws of food preparation. And so there was this kind of weird back and forth between prohibitions, but then also teaching people who didn't have access to Jewish beliefs or Jewish practice, they actually ended up teaching them about it too. So that kind of goes back and forth. So the Inquisition and how it functions in my work, the Carvajal women were brought up on Inquisition charges. They came up under two separate trials. In the first trial, and this is in New Spain, in the first trial they were all kind of separated because they were a part of this big group of Judaizers, of crypto-Jews, and when you're brought up to testify, they ask you to kind of rat out everybody else in your community. And you may not do it in the beginning, but eventually you do. And so there's this huge web and network of other people. They were all kind of slapped on the wrist, separated, but eventually went back to practicing crypto-Judaism and were brought up on a second trial and ultimately perished and were put to death in an auto de fe, which is the big public execution. And so these auto de fes are really part of early modern society where they're trying to say, okay, for really bad wrongdoers who don't repent, we're going to do this public exercise that shows the populace, this is how you should not behave. And if you do, this is the punishment. And so that's their sad end. When I was working through these documents, when I was thinking about it purely academically, you know, you can get through it. But if you think about it, these are people who, you know, were kept in the jail cells for so many months and what that looks like. So
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Yeah, it's heartbreaking. Speaking of public spectacle and kind of performance, I wonder if you could use an explanation of the auto sacramental to tell us a bit about the argument that you lay out in the chapter you've entitled Esther in Iberia and Constructing a Catholic Nation Upon the Judeo-Christian Model.
Sure. Yeah. So something that you had said earlier, actually, just about these two different ways of looking at these Esther texts, I think really resonates with that question. In that chapter, we're talking about, and when I think when the conclusion of looking at all of these, the texts about Esther from a Christian perspective, is that they're upholding notions of obedience to a really central authoritative power, which is the Catholic kings, and then the other, the Catholic royals being Isabel and Ferdinand, and then later the other Catholic emperors. And kings. And so these auto sacramentales are one act plays that often were performed, and I couldn't find specific information when these were performed or where, but generally auto sacramentales are performed in front of, as part of big important celebrations. They're plays that are performed for the masses, so many who could have been illiterate, and were intending to teach norms and values to these people. And so when they were, so my question was, what is Esther, how is celebrating a Jewish heroine going to help the Catholic nation? What I found were the aspects that were celebrated were ideas of obedience, and thinking about that gendered lens, female virtue, female obedience also within that schema, and upholding notions of femininity that were really prevalent in that time period, that kind of circumscribed women within set boundaries. And that idea of that public spectacle was centrally important to those types of texts. And so it was kind of the counter, an important counterpoint to texts written by crypto-Jews about their experiences with Esther.
That's fascinating. So, I mean, it seems like there's this aspect of, you know, mobilizing Esther as this idealized woman that I don't know, it's a very sort of post-Foucauldian idea of it sort of undermines itself in a way, right? That like on the one hand, you have Esther being mobilized as the ideal of feminine virtue, but then if you consider all of the other features that you're going to bring out in the rest of the book, you know, isn't it ironic that they're using Esther as this amazing, virtuous Christian woman who in fact is this kind of subversive figure that stands up for her community's rights? And
yeah, and I think that's the ambiguous part of the Book of Esther that lends itself to this period, because, I mean, before actually really delving into this project, when I was a kid, I dressed up as Queen Esther for Purim, but I dressed up as Queen Esther because she was the beautiful queen, and there's not that many Jewish queens that are celebrated. But always kind of thought, well, she won a beauty contest. She paraded herself naked. She's not a heroine for women. She's not this exceptional character figure. But I think she does straddle multiple identities, and she can be interpreted in different ways. And to some certain people, she is not a heroine. And to certain people, she's just kind of upholding feminine notions of idealized beauty that are not subversive. But that's what's interesting to me about these different retellings, because they do shed different light on her and she on the period, I think.
So could you so moving on from the spectacle of autos sacramentales to thinking about another form of public spectacle that was also being performed in front of massive numbers of people, and here I'm thinking about Lope de Vega as one of the most popular playwrights of early modern Spain. In chapter three, you move from discussing his play La Hermosa Esther to discussing another set of texts written by a converso who, as you had mentioned previously, at some point would be investigated and punished by the Spanish Inquisition. So I thought maybe you could start by telling us a little bit about Lope and about his play, and then explain, as you do in the chapter, the relationship of his work to that of the lesser known converso discussion of Esther.
Sure, yeah. So Lope de Vega is this incredibly prolific, important playwright in early modern Spain. And he puts on the stage La Hermosa Esther, and it is performed on the stage. The idea of spectacle is supremely important because for the Spanish early modern theater, this was a mass way of communicating with the people. And there was these huge corrales, which are the places where people would sit and stand and watch. And there's many theorists who've talked about how it's this place that brings the upper and lower classes together to partake in diversion, but also things that teach them about their society. And so Lope de Vega's play was performed on the stage, and it stands to reason that Godines, they lived in similar places, would have seen this play on the stage, and Lope de Vega's play was written before Godinez's. And Lope de Vega, what we see in his play, in his version of La Hermosa Esther, are these notions of beauty being upheld. He does create a genealogy of women that he dedicates his play to. So I find that important and intriguing. Like, this is, it's a male playwright, but it's written about a woman for women. And so there is this kind of like feminine criticism that's going on. A lot of the play upholds feminine virtues. Esther is a beautiful figure, and it kind of maintains that narrative of obedience to the nation state, but it also celebrates a female figure, which does stand out in that period. Godinez, his two works, and they're written on either side of his Inquisition trial. It's kind of, the second is really a rewriting of the first. They're two totally different texts. The first one is titled La Reina Esther. The second is Amán y Mardoqueo, so Haman and Mordecai. So the just from the titles, he's taking away this centrally important female figure, and that is shown throughout the text. And instead, he focuses on these two masculine figures. And there's a whole series of objects that he works through. In the first, it celebrates this Jewish figure and different aspects of her Judaism, and quite blatantly. In the second text, in Amán y Mardoqueo, it's a Christianized version, and we see celebrations of the Virgin Mary in place of Esther. And so it kind of, to me, what it said was he was instructed, Godinez was instructed in the correct Catholic way at the time, of how to Christianize his work. Godinez was also a priest, so there is something which is pretty common for conversos in general. Converso families, in order to show that they were obedient to the regime and were good Christians, they would encourage a member of their family to join the priesthood. And so Govindas has this interesting background. A couple of his family members were also brought up on Inquisition charges, some were exiled from Spain and punished in other ways. So there are all of these tensions in the biography of this figure that play out in his texts as well.
That's really fascinating. Do you see the Godinez, the second work, as converging to the more sort of hegemonic text of Lope, or is he creating an entirely different sort of image of Esther?
I think it becomes more of the hegemonic order mandates of the society, more alongside the auto sacramentales. In terms of, in some ways, the first text that Godinez writes, La Reina Esther, dialogues with Lope's text, La Hermosa Esther, because he is celebrating and upholding this female figure and her virtues above all else. But it is interesting to me that there's these three plays written almost around the same time period by a really well-known playwright and then a lesser known, but about this centrally this figure.
So then in the second half of the book, you kind of expand beyond Spain to the Sephardic diaspora. And in the first of these, which you look at in chapter 4, you discuss this instead of a dramatic celebration of Esther, you're now talking about poetic celebrations written by João Pinto Delgado, a converso Jew from Portugal, who you say winds up connecting with the Nassau Portuguesa in Amsterdam and then ends up in France. So I thought, again, just to get a little bit of background history, how do we end up with Sephardic Jews in Amsterdam? Why is Pinto Delgado's kind of itinerary through these different European spaces important? Why are there conversos in Portugal at this time that he's writing?
Yeah. So the borders between Spain and Portugal at this time were pretty fluid. There was an Inquisition established first in Spain, then later in Portugal, and there was some decrees that allowed the converso that allowed Portuguese conversos to kind of return to Spain. So there was this free movement going back and forth. João Pinto Delgado's family was originally from Spain, moved to Portugal, and they were converso Jews. And as we talked about earlier, he kind of was separated from these normative ways of practicing Judaism, because we're talking about, you know, 100 plus years after the expulsion of the Jews from Iberia. And although the Inquisition happened slightly later in Portugal, we're still a ways away. Given the chance, there were many Portuguese conversos who moved outside of Iberia, and a big community was founded in Amsterdam. And they kind of were known as the Nassau Portuguesa, because it was such a critical mass. Some ended up returning because it didn't work for them, and they weren't readily accepted within the normative orthodoxy of Amsterdam at that time. But Pinto Delgado ended up staying there for a number of years and then continued on to France, where he lived as an important Jewish member of that community. I think the story of the Portuguese Nassau is really interesting, because it really is a dynamic one that moves, and they ended up in Amsterdam was a huge had a huge maritime trade, as did Portugal, and so they ended up moving to far-flung places. Officially, conversos weren't supposed to leave the peninsula, and they were mandated not to, but there were ways of getting fake records, or if you had a connection that allowed you to leave, or if you had enough money together and somehow made your way out. But this was a really dynamic, mobile community, which I find particularly interesting.
Yeah. And now maybe you could tell me about how is Pinto Delgado kind of representative of this community? And what does his representation of Esther tell us about how his community saw itself, you know, vis-a-vis the rest of the Sephardic Jewish diaspora? And more broadly, how is it different? How is it similar from other representations of Esther that you've talked about already?
Yeah, sure. So, to move back for one moment, in Godinez's text, Godinez is one of the only converso that I found that has been able to write about Esther, and we can see the revisions that have happened because of where he was living and what those limitations are. Pinto Delgado is now, in a sense, free to write about whatever he wants. He's not within Iberia. He's not within the borders of the peninsula, and he's not within the reach of the Inquisition. And so he's really able to express any ideas of longing, of missing a homeland. And that's what we see in his long poem about Esther. We see the maritime images, the sea features prominently, and this idea of missing home and missing a homeland. And when we talked earlier about this dual notion of homeland for Sephardic Jews being Spain and Israel, or we have this centrally important piece, which is missing home and thinking about home, and this kind of center of Spain that emerges for this author. And then this celebratory way that he's able to relate about Esther and her being this Jewish heroine and queen, and really being, he's really the only figure that's really openly able to express all of these ideas without fear of retaliation or retribution. And I think it's a really central part of his identity as a Sephardic Jew, as a member of the Nassau Portuguesa, as somebody who's living in the diaspora, because Esther becomes queen of the conversos in the diaspora. And so it is really important to move outside of those boundaries and follow her to these different places that she's kind of saying to people, look, I'm a heroine. Well, she's not saying I'm a heroine, but they see in her this figure that resists adversity and flourishes. And I think that comes out in his poem, that we can survive and we can move on and we can have successful lives outside of those previous limitations. And so that idea really comes out in this work.
That's really fascinating. So speaking of Esther moving in this sort of global environment, you finish with texts that you've brought up a couple of times now. This time produced by, as you've said, Crypto-Jewish Women in the Diaspora in New Spain. How was Crypto-Judaism in the New World fundamentally different than Crypto-Judaism in Europe, or was it?
Fundamentally, I don't think it was so different. There was less observation, because if you lived in a very rural part of New Spain, there was just the inquisitors were really located within urban centers, so within what is today Mexico City. And so when the Carvajal family actually first began and they lived in kind of far-flung places, they weren't really as suspect. And so in that way, there were some differences. But in terms of the lives that they led in these urban centers, which eventually led to their demise, Crypto-Judaism really manifested in many parallel ways for women and men across the boundaries. And the dates of when Crypto-Judaism flourished the most and when it declined were fairly similar, because these these are people who still, although they weren't, they were living thousands of miles away, they still had contact with the old world. In terms of the Carvajal family, they made it to the New World as a really family unit. There was one brother who was left behind, who was a priest, actually. He became a priest, and he stayed in the Old World. The rest of the family made it to the New World, even though they weren't supposed to, because their uncle was the governor of Nuevo León, and he was called Luis de Carvajal, the El Viejo, the elder. And he was the one who kind of was able to, although he wasn't a crypto Jew, he maintained firmly that he wasn't, although his wife was in the old world. He brought this family and allowed them to relocate.
Do you have any sense of how did he sort of get around the restrictions on conversos traveling outside of the Iberian Peninsula, or is that not part of the archival record?
That is a good question. I don't know exactly how he ended up getting there and was able to, but I know that because of his connections and his importance, the rest of the Carvajal family did. They left kind of with the idea that it would protect them to be someplace further away from the Suprema and the centers of the Inquisition. And that kind of speaks to your question. And then it didn't quite pan out in that way for them.
And so then where does Esther come in for the Carvajal sisters? So how does she come into that story?
So as I was mentioning before, as I theorized that Crypto-Judaism is a matriarchal religion, and I'm not alone in Miriam Bodium has an excellent work that talks about this, David Gray's board, and but we think about Crypto-Judaism being a matriarchal religion, and so these voices of these women and what they're saying, and they're the ones remembering the prayers and teaching them, it becomes this home-centered, home-based religion, and the women really use their bodies to maintain their crypto-Jewish practices through things like fasting, some self-flagellation, and within all of these trials that they kind of endure and put themselves through, they talk about Queen Esther as their Saint Esther, and she becomes really parallels those other figures of the Virgin Mary, and she becomes their heroine, and they talk about and they observe the fast of Queen Esther. So within the story, the biblical story of Queen Esther, there's a fast and a feast. And the feast is not something that they can do. It's public. They're living as public Christians and secret Jews, private Jews. They can't openly feast because they had servants. There was lots of eyes watching them. But they could observe the fast. And so they observed really strict fasts, like 3-day fasts for Queen Esther, which started at from sunrise to sundown. And that really became a part of their bodily centric worship, and they venerated Esther, and they talk about her a lot, and they say, we do this in honor of Saint Esther or Queen Esther, and they say prayers to her. In their private letters, they refer to her as Saint Esther, and they venerate this heroine that flourished in adversity, and this is the exact situation that they're living in. So she becomes this patron saint of crypto-Judaism, and it also gives them a place. There's so much they can't control, but by invoking this figure, who is a really, for other writers, as we've seen in the beginning, we talk about her beauty and her virtue as a woman, they take this in a different way, and it becomes a bodily female space that they're able to control. Through fasting, through different obediences that they invoke. And this is they're doing in thinking through Esther as a figure that they can pray to and that is their queen and the person that's anchoring their belief.
That's fascinating. It's almost this syncretic idea of a Judeo-Christian figure of you know, a patron saint, which obviously isn't really a figure that tends to emerge in Judaism. So it's fascinating that is the sort of image of Esther that comes out of your final chapter. Could you maybe just sum up what are some of your big conclusions from this project?
Sure. So one of the main things I think about is the idea of a Sephardic difference, and that speaks to the female figure, the Sephardic difference being located in the female body, that is a figure that is global, that is a border transgressor. I think of Esther as this early modern globetrotter and as a cultural chameleon, and that's something that you just touched on also, this kind of mixed figure that you can't totally separate one from the other, and that's something that the crypto-Jews, you know, they living a public life as one, a private life as other, you can't totally divorce where one begins and the other ends. The idea that another main conclusion is the idea that Sephardic identity exists beyond geographical borders. And as we talked about, the idea of contesting national boundaries is the only option for identity and thinking about identity in new ways. And really just another way of thinking of the 16th and 17th centuries, and who are the models and the figures that stand out to different people. Esther's not somebody that jumps to the top when we think about Iberia in the 16th and 17th centuries, but she's highly represented and she means a lot of things to different people.
Yeah, I mean, it's so wonderful to have such an in-depth study of a woman that was so significant, because I feel like with the exception of Isabel la Católica, there really are so, you know, the early modern period is such a male-dominated world that it's fascinating to hear such a rich description of a woman that signified so widely and so globally and not just on the Iberian Peninsula. So we've taken up a lot of your time today, but before I let you go, I wonder if you could tell us a bit about what you're working on now.
Sure, I'd be happy to. I recently was in Sevilla on sabbatical, and I was looking at the payments to wet nurses from the 17th century for the Casa Cuna, which is basically an orphanage. And so what I'm focusing right now on is practices of breastfeeding and wet nursing in that time period, and looking at notions of ethnic and religious difference, and also ideas like the breast is best, how that manifested in early modern Spain, and who were the right and who were the wrong people there is to nurse these children. There's tons of treatises about what women should and shouldn't do, and many of them are male authored. And so I am, and it's not that different than today. So I'm thinking about all of those ideas currently.
That's really interesting. Well, thank you so much for being on the show today. It was great to get to catch up with you and hear a little bit more about your work. And I hope to get to talk to you soon.
You as well. Thank you so much.